You definitely don't want to miss next Sunday. Next Sunday, we have the privilege of having Dr. Johnny Miller, who is the president of Columbia International University, here preaching for us. Johnny Miller is a great scholar, a great teacher of the Bible, but also a great statesman for the missionary movement in the United States. Columbia Bible College, or Columbia International University, I guess as it's called now, is probably the foremost sending school in the United States training young people for missionary service. And we have a rare privilege of having Johnny Miller here, and I want to really encourage you to come prepared to hear from God. It's an unusual opportunity to be able to have him, and so we're so excited to see him. And unfortunately, the bad news is I'm going to miss him because I'm going to be in Kazakhstan next week for a week teaching in our Central Asia Leadership Training School. I'll be teaching a class in leadership to about 30 church planters, and so you all can pray for me next week as I travel over to Kazakhstan. Do y'all remember the Eagles song, Peaceful, Easy Feeling? You remember that song? You may not remember the words. I like the way your sparkling earrings lay against your skin so brown. And I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight with a billion stars all around. Because I get a peaceful, easy feeling. And I know you won't let me down. That song must have been written by a guy, right? That song was written and sung during the era when everybody wanted to be easy. Now, if you think about it, the song for just a little bit, being easy in that particular situation is not necessarily a compliment. But we, as a culture, made an incredible error after World War II. Because we took two concepts that were really different from each other. The shade of meaning was near, but the concepts were really different. And we merged them together in our affluence and created a blurring. We took the word peace, or being at peace, or peaceful, and we married it together with easy, being easy. And those concepts are not the same. Peace is the absence of conflict. It's the absence of hostility. It's the absence of animosity. To be peaceful inside means that you do not have a war going on within you. Ease, or easy, on the other hand, is a completely different concept. It's the idea of not having difficulty. It's the absence of difficulty. The two are not the same. Let me give you an example in marriage. In marriage, you can have peace without ease. In fact, I have met very few people that have been married very long that have ease. In fact, part of the reason why I see our culture breaking up families right and left is because we believe that it ought to be easy. If you found the right person and if you really love each other, there shouldn't be any difficulties. It should be easy to relate, easy to communicate, easy to get along, easy to understand each other. And so therefore, if any of those things are not present, you know, in order to be at peace with myself, I've got to break this relationship off and find one that's easy. Whereas the marriages that survive are the marriages that recognize we've got a common commitment. We have established a truce. We have established peace. We're going to work through our conflicts, even though it's not going to be easy, even though it's going to be hard. Now, the problem is whatever the culture does with their definitions, sooner or later, Christianity will do the same thing. And what I'm afraid of is part of the reason why we struggle with God is because we believe that God ought to be easy. He ought to be easy too. And for those of you who have been reading through the Bible, that's our number one goal this year, and I know all of you have been reading through, so you're in about Deuteronomy now. When you got to Leviticus, something kind of shouted out really loud at you, didn't it? What shouted out really loud at you is, God is not easy. God is not easy. God has some ideas of right and wrong. He doesn't just kind of brush over holiness. He's not the kind of God who just looks the other way at evil. God takes a very serious stand when it comes to sin. God is anything but easy. So how do I have peace with God? How do I have peace with God? Is there any way to work through that? And then what happens when life is not easy? When I face major difficulties in life, am I to assume that God has let me down? Or can I have peace even when things are not easy, even when things are difficult? This morning we're going to look at the last chapter of the book of Habakkuk. And for those of you who are joining us new, this is the fifth message on the three-chapter book of Habakkuk. And you probably have been wondering when I'm going to get to the end of it. Well, I'm at the end of it today. Okay? It was very timely that we're teaching through this book at a time when our nation is sitting here looking at the potential of war. Maybe it's piqued our attention a little bit. And in the book of Habakkuk, we have a minor prophet with a major problem. The minor prophet with a major problem is doing the opposite of what we would expect out of a prophet. You know, most prophets listen to God, they hear Him tell something, and then they tell everybody else, but not Habakkuk. Habakkuk's been listening to everybody else and looking at his circumstances, and he's telling God. And what is he telling Him? Notice what he says in chapter 1, verse 3. In chapter 1, verse 3, he says, "Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? God, 5th century B.C. in Judah, looks like 20th century America, and I can't believe that you're not doing something to judge this people for their sin." God says, "Well, you just don't know." In fact, look at verse 5. "Look at the nations." This is God speaking, "and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your day that you would not believe even if you were told. I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own." God says, "I'm going to do something. You don't like the way your culture's going? I'll take care of it. I'm going to bring in the Babylonians, and they're going to take over your culture. They're going to mop up the earth with you. You're not going to have to worry about sin anymore here, at least from your own people, because the Babylonians are coming." To which Habakkuk says, "Oh my goodness, I prayed for the wrong thing." Have you ever gotten an answer to prayer? You said, "Oh man, I'm going to be more careful before I pray next time." Well, Habakkuk has another problem. So he looks back up to God and he says in verse 13, "Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves?" What he's saying is, "God, you're going to use wicked people to judge us? That's bad. That's worse than the way it was before." And God responds in chapter 2 and he says to Habakkuk, "Listen, I'm going to judge them too. In fact, I'm going to judge all proud people. I'll deal with the proud in the world." But he brings us to the key verse in the book, which is in chapter 2, verse 20. And here's what he says. God says, "But the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before Him." And last week we said that a literal translation of that phrase, "be silent," is very simple. Two words: shut up. God says, "I am seated in my temple. I'm above all of you. I've got the whole situation under control. I know what I'm doing. Shut up. Quit complaining. Quit griping. Life is not going to be easy for you, but I've got the whole thing under control." That brings us to the first lesson that Habakkuk is going to learn through this experience. And that is this: God is terrifying and terrific, so I'm never at ease. God is terrifying and terrific, so I'm never at ease. It's not easy with God. God is difficult. God's ways are hard. God doesn't always do things that makes life wonderful and grand. And I've got to come to grips face to face with that reality. In fact, look at what he says in verse 1 chapter 3. By the way, verse 1 of chapter 3 says, "The prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth." You say, what is Shigionoth? Well, that's a great question. The translators transliterated the Hebrew there because they don't have a clue as to what this word means either. It's probably some type of musical term. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, because if you look at the end of the chapter, it says, "For the director of music on my stringed instruments." This is actually a prayer that's put into song. This is a prayer that's put into song. And you'll notice throughout the song, the phrase Selah, which is also used in hymnic literature. In other words, when God told him to shut up, He didn't tell him to be quiet in the sense of zip your lip and don't let another word be heard. What he said was, quit complaining about the way I'm running the world. And in response to that, Habakkuk worships. He writes a song, and the song is incredible. Notice what he says in the first words of the song, verse 2. Lord, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds, O Lord. Renew them in our day, in our time make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. Now here's what he's saying. He says, O Lord, I've heard of your fame. The word fame comes from a word that means secondhand information. He said, you know, when I was a boy bouncing on my mother's knee, she told me all the stories about you. I heard you were awesome. I heard you did great things. I heard you were incredible. I heard about the Egyptians. I heard about all of the things that you did to get us where we are today. And you know what I thought? I thought, you know, I want to meet this guy sometime. He sounds like a really awesome dude. I had heard of your fame. But now he's saying, I have heard from you face to face. I know what you're going to do. And he says, I stand in awe of your deeds. The word awe there literally means I stand in fear of you. You see, at one point in time, he had an easy view of God. God's a great, big, wonderful guy. He does great things for our people. But now that I know what God really does, now that I really understand him, now that I'm close and personal with you, man, I'm afraid of you. I am fearful. I am never at ease in your presence. He goes on to say, renew them, that is your deeds, renew them in our day. In our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. He says, God, if you need to use the Babylonians, bring them on. If that's one of your great works, bring them on. What he's saying is, in our day, we want a fresh manifestation of God's power, even if it means judgment. How many of you would be willing to say that about the United States? God, if you chose to judge the United States, I would like to see a fresh manifestation of your power in our day, even if that makes my life hard. Because that's what he's saying. But he also reminds him, he says, in the midst of that, remember mercy. He's asking for a full measure of God's mercy. Now, from verses 13 through 15, we've got an incredible song of a proportion that I don't know that I can even begin to communicate it to you. If you're a native Hebrew speaker and you were engulfed in the culture of the Jews and you understood all the allusions, maybe you could get the magnitude of what's going on here. I'm going to take about 5 minutes to walk you through this and give you as many allusions as I can to help you understand what's going on here. But you really need to go back and read this over and over again. And here's the movement. The movement is Habakkuk is standing on the wall. He's looking out. He's waiting to see what God's going to do. And Habakkuk visualizes God coming. But God is not coming in the flesh, so to speak. God is coming in history. And he goes all the way back to the founding of the nation of Israel, and he traces the history. And what he's saying is, as I watch the march of history to this moment, I can see that you were on your throne in the past, and you were doing great things, and you've never left your throne, and history is marching toward this day, and you're in control. And it's absolutely incredible as he weaves together through all these literary allusions the incredible nature of God. Look at verses 3 through 7. He says, God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. Now those two phrases, those two locations are located somewhere in the desert near Mount Sinai. And he's saying, this is the beginning. You're coming from Sinai and coming forward. He says, his glory covered the heavens. His praises filled the earth. His splendor was like the sunrise. Rays flashed from his hands where his power was hidden. Plague went before him. Pestilence followed his steps. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. Here's what he's saying. He's saying, God, you started to move forward in history at Mount Sinai when you gave the law. And when you spoke, the world changed. With you, he says in verse 5, came pestilence, plagues, the 10 plagues on Pharaoh that destroyed the nation of Egypt. And you, as you marched forward to bring your people into the promised land, it was like a catastrophic shaking of the nations. The picture here is of a schoolboy with a globe in his hand. Have you ever seen those beach balls that are the beach ball with the world on the outside? You know, the kids on the beach just kind of bouncing them back and forth to each other. The picture is of God taking the world like a schoolboy would take a beach ball and just shaking it. And you think, if God can shake the whole globe, what does that do to the nations on the globe? And how small are the armies of the nations on that globe? And how much smaller are the individual kings on the face of that globe? If God can take the world and just shake it, what upheaval is going to take place? You see, when God shook the Egyptians, they were the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. And God took the likes of that little band of Hebrews, and He released them from the most powerful army on the face of the earth, and it was just like shaking a ball. He says, God, You're so powerful that even those things that we deem permanent, like mountains that have been around for a long time, they're nothing compared to Your eternality. In fact, You shook the world so hard when You liberated us from the Egyptians that the people living miles away in the tents of Cushan, in the land of the Midianites, they heard about what was happening and they got sick to their stomachs. The words anguish describe the fear of the nations when they heard what God was doing. In verse 8, we pick up another literary allusion. In verse 8, He says, "Were You angry with the rivers, O Lord?" Really, that probably would be better translated currents, because He's talking about God's incredible work in the oceans. He says, "Were You angry with the currents, O Lord? Was Your wrath against the streams? Did You rage against the sea when You rode Your horses and Your victorious chariots? You uncovered Your bow, You called for many arrows, You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw You and withered, torrents of water swept by, the deep roared and lifted its waves on high." I think we have two literary allusions here. The first one is to the great flood. It says, God, You took Your bow and You shot Your arrows at the world. Now, remember what happened after the flood, what God did? Remember He told Noah, "I'm going to put a sign for you in the heaven. I'm going to hang my bow up in the heaven." And we go out there and we look at all the colors of the rainbow, you know, the prism that reflected through the water particles, and we say, "Isn't that sweet?" And it is sweet. But it's a reminder of something that's not sweet. It was a reminder of the flood, where God took His arrow of, or His bow of water, and aimed it at the earth and drew tight the string and fired the arrow and destroyed the earth, saving only Noah and his family. And God hung it in the sky as a reminder that He will never destroy the earth again with water. But Peter says there's a time coming when He will destroy it with fire. In addition to that, God parted the Red Sea, and the Egyptian horses rode into the Red Sea and they drowned there. And God acted in power over the elements and over the earth to deliver His people. We see in verse 11, "The sun and the moon stood still in the heavens at the glint of Your flying arrows. At the lightning of Your flashing spear, in wrath You strode through the earth, and in anger You threshed the nations. You came out to deliver Your people, to save Your anointed. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness. You stripped him from head to foot." Now this is graphic. Verse 14, "With His own spear You pierced His head. When His soldiers stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour and the wretched who were in hiding, You trampled the sea with Your horses, churning the great waters." I believe in this section there are an allusion to many of the battles that were fought through the history of the nation of Israel. We see the battles that were fought when God made the sun stand still. In Joshua chapter 10, when Joshua called out to the heavens in the midst of a battle, and God stopped time in order to allow the Israelis to finish their war, to complete their battle. We see here in the situations where God was beating all of the enemies of the nation of Israel as the nations rose up against Him. And then we come to the end of the section where we've been seeing God's power and His destructive power in judging the nations. And we read in verse 16, "I heard and my heart pounded. My lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled." Now here's the sound of a guy falling apart. He says, "I heard You coming through history, marching forward with judgment. I heard the sound of You coming through history toward me. And when I heard that, I started to fall apart." He said, "My heart began to pound." In Hebrew, heart represents the bowels. He said, "My insides began to churn. I began to get sick to my stomach." He said, "My lips began to quiver." Have you ever been so scared that your lips shook? You say, "Well, I've been so angry that my lips shook." Have you ever been so scared? He says, "My bones couldn't support my weight. I mean, I just felt like collapsing." and my knees were knocking together. Why? Habakkuk? Why? If God is so terrific, why would you be so afraid? Well, you see, in all of the situations that he's described up to this point, Israel was the good guy. And God was protecting them against the bad enemies. But what is happening in his day now? Israel is not the good guy this time. Israel is the bad guy. And God is riding with the Babylonians to come in and judge the nation of Israel for their sin. And Habakkuk is seeing this and he's saying, God, if you did all of these things to our enemies, and now we've become the enemy, what are you going to do to us? And he's petrified. You see, this ain't going to be easy. When God judges the nation for their sin, this is going to be hard. Because God is terrible, or terrifying and terrific. I'm never at ease with him. In C.S. Lewis's book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he tells about a really interesting encounter. In his allegory, he portrays Jesus Christ as the lion, Aslan, and the children in the book are going through this story, and they run into a situation where they're going to meet Aslan. And I want to share this with you. Mr. and Mrs. Beaver are talking to the children in this fictitious story, and they're telling him about the great deeds of Aslan, and the kids are all excited about this incredible, incredible guy. And then they say, well, I want you to meet him. We're going to take you to meet him. And notice the conversation. But shall we see him? Asked Susan. Why, daughter of Eve, that's why I brought you here, for I am to lead you to where you shall meet him, said Mr. Beaver. Is he a man? Asked Lucy. Aslan a man? Said Mr. Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I tell you, he is king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who the king of the beasts is? Aslan is a lion, the great lion. Oh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie, and no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then... He isn't safe, said Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good, and he's the king. Same thing is true in this situation. God, are you safe? Not on your life, but he's good. Here's where Habakkuk learns the second truth, and that is this. Since God is terrifying and terrific, I'm also always at peace. Notice what he said in the latter half of verse 16. He said, yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come upon the nation invading us. The word patiently means quietly. In other words, I'm not going to complain when the judgment comes on us, because I know you're also going to judge the Babylonians. The calamity is going to come on them too. I can wait this out. Now here, he tells us how difficult waiting this out is going to be. Look at verse 17. Though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vine, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, and I will be joyful in God my Savior. He's saying when the Babylonians come in, they're going to wipe out our way of life. All of our prosperity is going to go down the drain. They're going to destroy everything here. He says, verse 17, there's going to be no fruit because the tree's not going to bud. They would cut the trees down. There'll be no wine because there will be no grapes on the vine. He says, there'll be no oil because the olive crop is going to fail. He says, there will be no bread because the fields will produce no food. After the Babylonians destroy the fields and destroy the harvest, there will be no bread. He says that there will be no meat because there are no sheep in the pen. And he says, there will be no milk because there are no cattle in the stalls. He says, everything we know about life when the Babylonians come in is going to be destroyed. And still, I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to be joyful in God my Savior. Now, how much loss, how much difficulty would it take for you to lose your peace? Well, let's test you here, okay?
Suppose these things were to happen to you. Suppose there was no VCR, cable TV, remote control, or CDs in the den. Would that take away your peace? You say, I could live without that. How about no dining out on the weekends? Suppose there were no Disney vacations in the summer, and no tents, campers, or condos in the spring and the fall. Would that take away your peace? How about no college fund for the kids? How about no IRAs, 401ks, or retirement plans for the future? You say, ouch, starting to get a little bit difficult. What if they were gone? You see, we haven't even gotten to where Habakkuk starts. What if there were no sports utility vehicle in the garage? No spare bedroom or study or second living area in the house? Would you lose your peace over that? Would life become too difficult? How about no money in the bank? Ooh, that's tough. No money in the bank? How about no dental, medical, or life insurance for a rainy day? How about no food on the table? How about no roof over your head? What would happen if you drove home today and when you got home, you found out that while we were sitting in here enjoying this climate-controlled environment, that a tornado had come through your neighborhood and your house was gone? You pull up in the driveway and it's gone. You go over to the neighbors, you call your insurance agent, only to find out that they had such great losses that the company went bankrupt and they didn't have any recourse to pay you. You say, oh, well, at least I've got a job. You show up at work tomorrow, only to find out you've been laid off because the president of the company left, stole all the assets of the company, and you have no retirement. You go to your bank, and your bank has failed. So you drive up to Burger King, and you put your credit card on the counter, and the cute little 16-year-old across the counter picks up your credit card and quickly cuts it in half and says, have a nice day. You can't use this anymore. What would you do? Would you say, well, hey, I'm going to rejoice in God. I'm going to rejoice in God. See, that's what Habakkuk says. How can he say that? Because he's learned a truth in verse 19. He said, the sovereign Lord is my strength. Where is my strength? It's not in my stuff. It's not in my security. It's not in my nation. My strength is in a sovereign Lord, the God of history. That's where I find strength. And then what he says is very interesting. He says, he makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to go on the heights. You see, when the Babylonians roll in with their war machine, there's going to be one group that is not affected, and that's the deer. Because you know what they do? They just go higher up in the mountain. God has given them the ability with their feet to walk in places where humans can't walk, and they just climb up higher, and they ignore it. They live above the whole thing. God takes care of them, provides for their basic needs. And what he's saying, that's what God gives me the ability to do. Through spiritual insight, through a focus on him, he gives me the ability, no matter how bad my circumstances are, to live in a higher plane, to walk on higher mountains, because I am not dependent on this life being easy. I have a peace knowing that my God is with me and I can rejoice in him. You see, life may not be easy, but I'm always at peace with God. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father, there is a challenge. And the challenge is to trust you, to believe in you, to be confident in you, regardless of how difficult life may be. We bow before you as a congregation who's much in need of a redefining of the terms. The fact that you're not easy is the greatest thing that ever happened to us, because if you were easy, you wouldn't have gone through sending your son Jesus Christ to die on the cross for our sins. Father, but you've given us peace in him. Teach us to worship you in the face of problems and to trust you in the face of difficulty. For we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, lest you think I'm going to preach five messages from a book and not apply it, I'm not going to let you off so easy. You say, how in the world could you do that? It's very simple. I want to give you a truth. I want to give you a principle today that I want you to think about and meditate on, because this is the key. The question is, where do you have your eyes focused? Here's Habakkuk's problem. When Habakkuk first looked at the world, he had his eyes focused on his circumstances. He was gazing at his circumstances and glancing at God. Occasionally, he would look up from the problems, the difficulties, the trials that he was facing in life. Occasionally, he would look up just long enough to say, God, you should be big enough to handle this. And his eyes were focused on the here and now, on his problems, and not focused on God. God finally brings him to the point in chapter 2, verse 20, where he says, look at me, I'm in my holy temple. Look at me, I'm sitting in a place where I ought to be worshipped. If you would get your gaze on God with an occasional glance at your circumstances, you would not be struggling. And the question that each of us must ask is, where do we fix our gaze? Do we have our gaze fixed on the problems of life? Do we look to life? Do we worship life? Is life all there is? And occasionally we glance up at God to see if He's there? Or do we have our eyes firmly focused on God? And occasionally we glance at life. You see, that principle is true throughout every arena. Take your marriage, for example. If you're married, as long as your gaze is firmly fixed on the beauty of your spouse, as long as your eyes are locked in on that person, and occasionally you glance at the world around you, you know what you're going to see? When you glance at the world around you, you're going to say, boy, I'm so glad I'm married to you. It's when you fix your eyes on some other person outside your relationship, when you begin to gaze at some other person and gather in all of their beauty and all of their goodness, and occasionally you glance back at your spouse and say, boy, I wish you could be like them. I wish you could be like them. That's when marriage falls apart. The same is true in the area of materialism. If your eyes are firmly fixed on stuff, you find yourself window shopping, you've got magazines by the hundreds coming into your home to look through the stuff that you don't have. Every Saturday, you're at the car dealership checking out every automobile to see what's out there. You're constantly driving through the neighborhoods looking for new homes. If that's your focus, you have trouble seeing the things of God as a priority. Wherever you fix your gaze, that becomes the worship of your life. That becomes your God. You see, when you and I will make a commitment to put our gaze on God, to be in worship with Him, to spend time in His Word, in prayer, and serving Him, and making Him the priority, that is our gaze. The circumstances of life that we glance at from time to time will take on a whole new perspective. And you will be filled with a peace that transcends all that you understand today. The question is, are you gazing at God and glancing at your circumstances? Or are you gazing at your circumstances and glancing at God? And only you can answer that question. And as we get prepared to leave this morning, I want us to stop for just a moment. And I want you to bow your head and I want you to ask God, in the honesty of your heart as you sit before Him, God, help me. Help me understand where my eyes are. Am I gazing at You? Or am I gazing at something else? Let's bow our heads and just take a moment for you before God to ask that question.